From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Does a person's skull say anything about a person? I mean, could your skull be of any use once you're done using it? Well, my guest this week is Colin Dickey, the author of Craniocleptic: Grave Robbing and the Search for Genius. It is a gruesome and fascinating book, and it's all about skulls. Colin Dickey, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me on.
When did people begin to get obsessed with skulls?
Well, I guess people have been obsessed with skulls for a long time, I think, going back to, you know, early Christian relics and that sort of thing, and this idea that the relics of a saint, including, you know, bones, might give one a connection to the divine. But the book that I ended up writing sort of focused on the early 19th century, when people specifically became interested in skulls as a result of the new pseudo-science phrenology, which sprang up around 1790.
That's the reading of people's head bumps and so forth?
Yeah, exactly. The guy who invented it, Franz Josef Gall, he had this idea that if you... different parts of the brain were responsible for different aspects of one's personality, and that correspondingly different parts of the brain might be bigger or smaller depending on how well developed that faculty was. And furthermore, that these different parts of the brain might actually press against the skull and leave indentations and bumps. And so if you felt around somebody's skull, you could get an idea of how their different faculties were developed. You know, their memory might result in a certain bump here, and their, you know, propensity for marriage and children might result in a bump here, and you could sort of figure that out if you map the skull right.
Yeah, the idea that you could tell someone's future by reading their head bumps.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. That you could sort of read the whole thing, like, you know, not unlike a palm reading, but it was cloaked in a much more scientific veneer, and it was espoused as a very legitimate and objective science, and I think that's part of the reason why it caught on so well.
How did this guy, Gall, did he have some data to back him up?
Well, he started out as a regular medical student, and he was struggling in school because he wasn't very good at memorizing, and he was really jealous of those guys who could memorize things really well. And he realized, one could say in quotation marks, that the people who were best at memorizing also had really big eyes, you know, at least as he saw it. And so he decided that there must be a direct one-to-one correlation between eyes and memory, and so posited that part of your brain which controls memory is located right around the eyes, and so if you're really good at memorizing things, it would sort of cause your eyes to bulge out. And from there, he just went around, you know, comparing people's heads to what they were good at until he got, you know, some quote-unquote data as to what, you know, different parts of the head said. I mean, my favorite is the fact that Aaron Burr, the guy who shot Alexander Hamilton, had a large sort of ridge on the back of his, sort of at the base of his neck, and he'd also fathered a couple children out of wedlock, so Gall decided that base of your neck, that must be where your propensity for sort of sexual activity was, and why, you know, he was able to deduce that based solely on Aaron Burr as his primary criteria is kind of beyond me, but, you know, that was his objective method. So.
Now, was he examining Aaron Burr's skull while Burr was still using it, or later?
No, I think Burr was still alive. I think he was going off of portraits and just sort of facts. I mean, you get a sense of just how rigid of a scientist he was, but, you know, this was nonetheless, you know, how he proceeded, and it really caught on. People really believed this. I think at the time they were really looking for something like this, some way to understand the brain, because at this point in science, you know, the brain was really... You know, we finally understood that it was a really important part of the body, but we had no tools for measuring it or understanding it. And so Gall's science, as ridiculous as it was, I mean, it was an answer to that question in a way that people were really craving. So.
And is it ridiculous? I mean, is the skull of a genius any different from the skull of a moron?
Well, no. I mean, the one thing that Gall did get right, surprisingly, was this idea of what's now called localization, the idea that different parts of the brain control different things. And, you know, how he came to that was completely specious, but it's the sole thing that he's credited with having discovered. But beyond that, the notion that somehow that can be imprinted on, you know, a bone as rigid as one skull is pretty ridiculous. I mean, there's a fair amount of fluid between your brain and your skull anyway, so there's really no direct contact that could result in the kind of bumping and indentations that Gall theorized.
And was phrenology used to support racist beliefs at the time?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, as with a lot of sciences, I mean, you know, phrenology became synonymous with a kind of ideological doctrine, you know, that people who were, you know, morally deficient, you could sort of tell that by looking at their heads. And so indeed, yeah, Gall and other phrenologists became very interested in the skulls of criminals and the skulls of the insane because they could, you know, quote-unquote prove that these people were morally and mentally deficient by looking at, you know, a low-sloped forehead or something like that. You know, and this quickly also grew to include kind of imperialist and sexist doctrines where, you know, white European males became sort of the paradigm of great, rounded, perfect skulls. And, you know, as you can imagine, people from Africa or Native Americans or women were just proof of underdeveloped and, you know, problematic skulls.
Now, how did it grow from a fad of fortune telling to stealing the skulls of famous people?
Well, for phrenology, there were really three people that were really important. There were criminals and the insane, as I mentioned, because those were deficient examples of humans. And then on the other end, there were the category of great geniuses, which were exemplary humans. And so, you know, you needed all three, really, to really understand how the brain worked. And so phrenologists really wanted great examples of great criminals and of great, you know, mental patients and also great geniuses. And it was really easy to get the first two because if you wanted a criminal's remains, you just showed up at an execution. Nobody really wanted, you know, the body after it was done with, so you could just scoop up a head if need be. It was pretty easy to bribe somebody at an insane asylum to let you poke around the cemetery and take what you needed. So, you know, people like Gall really had no problem getting that kind of material, but the heads of geniuses were a lot harder to come by, as you can imagine, because these were, you know, famous, well-liked, well-loved people, and, you know, if you wanted to steal the head or get the head of a genius, you had to go through it through some pretty subterranean means.
Such as?
Well, what I talk about in the book, and I think still one of my favorite stories on this subject, is the skull of the composer Franz Joseph Haydn, who was arguably at his time really the most famous composer. I mean, Mozart had flamed out early, and he hadn't quite developed the reputation he had today, and, you know, Beethoven was still quite young, so Haydn was really the guy. And when he died in 1809, a friend of his, somebody who had worked with him and worked for him, but who was an avid phrenologist himself, this guy, Joseph Carl Rosenbaum, decided that the best way to memorialize his friend would be to break into the cemetery less than a week after Haydn had died and bribe the gravedigger to dig up the corpse and cut off his head. And that's what he did.
And years later, according to your book, they found just his wig.
Right, exactly, yeah. Haydn had died in 1809, right as Vienna was under siege by Napoleon for about the third time, and so there really wasn't a lot of resources for a big formal burial. So he got kind of a small burial in a small church, and it wasn't until 11 years later that the Esterhazy prince, who was you know, his employer, finally got around to giving Haydn the proper burial that he deserved. And so in the process of transporting his body from Vienna back to the city where the Esterhazys were located, which is the city of Eisenstadt, in the process of that transportation, they discovered that Haydn's head had been missing for some time and caused this big furor and this big scandal about Nicholas II, who couldn't really keep track of the remains of his composer. So Nicholas launched a massive police investigation to figure out what happened to his head, and they, you know, finally tracked down Rosenbaum and his friend Johann Peiter, who had helped him with this whole thing. And the two of them, first they gave the prince a head and said, yeah, sure, this is the head, but it was the wrong head. It was the head of a boy. So, you know, they came back to Rosenbaum's house, and, you know, his wife was sort of oddly lying in bed at the time in the middle of the day, and they didn't really know what was going on with that, but, you know, Rosenbaum quickly gave them another head, and this one sort of looked like Haydn, so they buried it, and it wasn't until Rosenbaum's death that it was revealed that he had given them a second fake head, and that the real head was, in fact, under his wife's in the bed. She had basically been made to lie down on top of it so nobody would see it.
Well, before you tell me about other famous skulls that have been stolen, let me ask you this. Now, let's say you have someone's head, and they're no longer making active use of said head. How do you get the skull out of it?
This is something Rosenbaum had to figure out through trial and error. Before he even stole Haydn's head, he had done a practice run on an actress. He had sort of made the decision he wanted Haydn's head. He knew it was going to be difficult. He knew the best way to do it was to go through a trial run. So there was an actress who's not very well remembered today named Elizabeth Roos, who had died in childbirth in 1808. And so Rosenbaum and his friend Peiter, went through the whole process, got the gravedigger to dig up the body and cut off the head. And there they were with this, kind of gruesomely still decomposing head they really didn't know what to do with. So they took it home, they stuck it in a jar and filled it with lime water, which is a mixture of quicklime and water that quickly gets to a boiling point really quickly because of the chemical reaction. And this is great for cleaning heads and cleaning bone in general, because it boils off all the skin and the muscle and that kind of thing, but it leaves the bone itself intact. So they would basically just change the water every so often and just, keep kind of boiling it there. But problem with Elizabeth Roos is that they left her in there a little too long, and eventually she started sprouting algae. It was kind of a fiasco and kind of a botched job. So
if you're taking notes, listeners.
Exactly. I had to, for the research in the book, I got in touch with a taxidermist in San Francisco who does authentic Victorian taxidermy, who was a great resource in sort of walking me through all the different ways in which one could go about sort of preparing bones and pitfalls to avoid. And precisely Rosenbaum and Peiter made a lot of these classic mistakes that ended up in a green algae-ridden head. So when they finally got Haydn's head, they just took him to a professional. They didn't go through that a second time.
We're talking to Colin Dickey, and his book is called Craniocleptomy, Grave Robbing, and the Search for Genius. Not to dwell on the gruesomeness, but, why not? How do you get the brain out of it? I mean, isn't the brain sort of sealed in there? Do you have to cut it open?
I think the best way to do it, there's, and I'm gonna forget the name of the bone, but the bone that is basically on the bottom of the skull that has a little hole for the spinal cord, but sort of keeps the brain in there. You gotta kind of flip over the head and take that bone out, basically, and hollow it out, and then you can scoop out the brain, which, according to Rosenbaum's diary, and again, this gets pretty gruesome. I mean, the brains were usually the first thing to go bad, and smelled pretty bad.
Lovely.
What's that?
Lovely.
Yeah, it's pretty gross. When I first started doing public readings of this, I'd kind of forgotten how gross it was, and I would look up and see the audience with their heads in their hands sort of turning green, and I kind of felt bad about that.
Well, you should. So who are some of the other famous people who've lost their heads post-mortem?
Well, Gall was from Vienna, and so phrenology really took off in Vienna. And so primarily Viennese composers really suffered this fate, not only Haydn, but Mozart, who was buried in a mass grave, and they dug his head up and saved that one for posterity.
Well, if it was in a mass grave, how did they know they had Mozart's head?
I thought this was really genius. The sexton who oversaw the burial knew that Mozart might be valuable someday. So what he did as they were preparing the body is he wrapped a metal wire around Mozart's neck and then, dumped him into the mass grave. And, these being mass graves, they had to dig them up every 10 years to make room for more remains. And so when they dug up the grave about 10 years later, the sexton just had to go through the remains until he found the body that had a metal wire wrapped around it, and then he had a pretty good idea that was Mozart. So he popped the head off and mounted him on a velvet cushion for all of posterity.
Now, is he still on this velvet cushion?
Yeah, he is. A lot of the skulls eventually made it back to the ground, but Mozart, since he was buried in a mass grave, didn't really have anywhere to go, so he is currently in the Mozarteum, the Mozart Museum in Vienna. He was on display for a long time, but the curators finally complained that he was creeping them out, so now he's in a vault somewhere. But yeah.
So now, the people who went about stealing these skulls, what was their profit in it? Was there a used skull market?
Yeah, there. Well, certainly. I mean, guys like Rosenbaum clearly did it out of scientific interest and out of love. You know, I mean, they revered these skulls as, you know, something like secular saints. But as this became more and more popular, there was definitely a market that sprung up. And one of my favorite stories is the English writer Sir Thomas Browne, who was a contemporary of Shakespeare and Milton, who had, while he was alive, he had written what a tragical abomination it is to have your bones gnawed from your grave. And then about 140 years after he died, that very thing happened to him. They were digging a plot next to his, and they inadvertently opened up his grave. And the sexton, this guy George Potter, who would later come to be known as Skull George, saw a business opportunity and popped up Thomas Browne's head, and subsequently tried to sell it. You know, he contacted a couple doctors in England; they weren't interested. But he finally found a buyer and made off with some amount of money. So definitely, as phrenology became more and more popular, and these skulls were notably rare, it became not so common, but you know, there were certainly instances where famous people's heads were stolen so that they could be sold on the black market.
So then, no doubt, there were commercial endeavors to prevent grave robbing.
Yeah, this was kind of a fascinating thing to read about and discover, is that along with these phrenologists who were stealing heads, there was an even bigger problem with grave robbing for medical schools, as anatomy really took off as a discipline and you really needed cadavers to do firsthand research on. You know, you needed bodies, and there wasn't anything like the modern protocol of donating your body to science, and so it was really difficult to get bodies. All you could really use were the bodies of executed criminals, and so medical schools started paying these grave robbers, who were known as resurrectionists, to dig up bodies that they could use in medical schools. And there was a huge epidemic about grave robbing all throughout the 19th century, and so all manners of contraptions were invented to keep your body from being molested. You know, you could have your coffin sort of encased in a metal cage, or there was something called the patent coffin, which was a really lavish coffin that couldn't be pried open with crowbars because of the way it was designed. And it was kind of a whole sub industry, both of grave robbing and anti-grave robbing theft devices. So.
Now, has anyone ever claimed to have a skull that was not genuine? You know, to say I have Hitler's skull or Jesus' skull or something.
Yeah, there was definitely a lot of that, a lot of people trying to pass off, ringer skulls. In the case of Haydn, after the police came back to Rosenbaum the second time and he gave them what turned out to be a fake skull, but you know, it looked like Haydn, so they bought it. They assumed it was his, and so they buried it with Haydn. And when Rosenbaum died in about 1855, his widow took Haydn's actual skull to the authorities and said, you know, hey, I've got Haydn's skull. You guys probably want it back. And they said, no, thanks. We already have Haydn's skull. You must have been duped. That must be some forgery that somebody sold you. We've had Haydn's skull for the past 35 years. So. So it often came to be the case that famous people ended up with more than one head as the years went on. Emanuel Swedenborg, who was a Christian mystic, founded a branch of Christianity appropriately titled Swedenborgianism, was another guy who had at least two skulls throughout most of the 19th and into the 20th century. His head was stolen, and then it was maybe stolen again, but there was always some sort of conflict as to who had the right skull of Emanuel Swedenborg.
Well, what about, is this still going on? Are people still stealing skulls?
Well, this was really popular in the beginning of the 19th century, in part because of phrenology, in part also because there was no way to preserve brains per se. You know, formaldehyde really hadn't been invented and wasn't in use until 1880, and so if you wanted to preserve any part of somebody, you had to go with bones because you couldn't preserve anything else. So as formaldehyde replaced, became the sort of default way of preserving bodies, brains replaced skulls as the thing that you wanted to keep. But by that point, phrenology had kind of fallen out of disuse anyways, and so people were not really all that interested in taking the heads of geniuses, although, you know, there's still the famous case of the doctor who performed the autopsy on Albert Einstein, who pretty much against the will of the family kept Einstein's brain, and there's that great book, Driving Mr. Albert, which tells that story. But probably the most famous example of skull stealing in the 20th century is George W. Bush's grandfather, Prescott Bush, who may very well have stolen Geronimo's head in about 1917 or so. Prescott was definitely not a phrenologist. He was a member of Yale's Skull and Bone Society, and if they took Geronimo's skull, they did it as pranks, most assuredly. But according to accounts, there is a head in the Skull and Bone Society that is referred to as Geronimo, although when Geronimo's descendants came to Yale and said, you know, can we please have our, you know, great-granddad's head back, we'd like to, you know, bury it, the Skull and Bone Society quickly changed their tune and said, oh no, that's not Geronimo's head, that's just some random guy, please go away now. So there's actually an open lawsuit now as to whose head that is and whether or not Geronimo's descendants have the right to get it back from Skull and Bones.
Could it be determined, DNA or something?
Yeah, it's a pretty it's an inexact science. You know, I mean, Mozart's head was subjected to a DNA test in 2002 just because it had come from a mass grave and they wanted to be sure, and so they compared it to two samples from two of his aunts, the skull didn't match either of the aunts' DNA samples, but the aunts didn't match each other either, so it was kind of inconclusive in that regard. And so, you know, I mean, you can do a lot with DNA, but it's not always easy to make a conclusive positive ID, especially if you don't have actual DNA from the, you know, in this case, Geronimo. I mean, I don't know if there's any locks of Geronimo's hair or anything like that still around, but without that, I think it's pretty difficult.
Does anybody know where the rest of Geronimo is?
It's a little confusing because in the Skull and Bones archive, when they describe how Prescott Bush stole Geronimo's head, they talk about breaking into this crypt in the middle of night and prying open these iron doors and all sorts of nonsense. But Geronimo was buried in a really simple grave, so that sort of casts some doubt on whether or not it's actually Geronimo's head or whether or not Prescott, I don't know, just picked a head out of somewhere and passed it off as Geronimo's. So I assume, yeah, the rest of his body is somewhere, but before they can do the DNA test, they have to get Skull and Bones to let them see it, and they've been pretty obtuse about the whole thing.
We're talking to Colin Dickey, and his book is called Craniocleptomy, Grave Robbing, and the Search for Genius. Now, you seem like a nice young man. How did you get involved in this gruesome subject?
Well, yeah, it's funny. I didn't necessarily think this was going to be the first book I was going to write, but I had known about Thomas Brown's head just because of the irony of somebody who had actively fretted about this possibility while he was in life, only to have it happen to him, you know, 150, 140 years later. And so, but I always just thought that was just kind of a one-off, and until quite by accident I read about the case of Goya, the Spanish painter whose head was also stolen, and his is the only head that I follow in the book that never turned up again. It's still sort of an open mystery. Nobody really knows what happened to Goya's head except that it was stolen sometime in the 19th century. It was hearing about these two completely different head thefts, different parts of Europe, different times, that made me think, well, you know, maybe there's something to this. And as I started learning more and more about these very stories, the story of Haydn and Beethoven and Swedenborg, and, you know, it seemed like there was something that had been going on that, you know, nobody liked to talk about. It was sort of this weird, almost fad that took place that subsequently had been almost erased from history, even though these are really famous people about whom long biographies have been written. So it seemed like something worth digging into.
Well, you've done a fine job. What are you going to do next? Do you have something else?
I'm working on a biography of Sarah Winchester, who some of your listeners may know.
The Winchester Mystery, huh?
Yeah, exactly. The woman who whose father-in-law invented the Winchester rifle, and after her own husband and daughter died, pretty quickly thereafter, she became convinced that she was being haunted by ghosts of everyone who had ever been killed by a Winchester rifle, and was told by a Boston psychic that the only way to keep them at bay would be to build a house that was never finished. So moved out to San Jose and started building this massive Victorian house that she worked on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for the next 37 years, and still standing. So it seems like there's something in there sometimes.
Oh, I think that'd be a lovely book, and I hope you'll come back and talk to us about it on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, I would love to.
Before you go, let me ask you this. Do you own a skull other than the one that's in your head?
No, I do not. When I first was researching this book, I happened to be walking through an antique store, and I saw a human skull for sale, and it crossed my mind that, you know, that seemed to be necessary, but then I just decided that I didn't want to be in the business of owning the remains of other humans, so I passed on it.
Yeah, what is a skull, you know, how much is a skull on eBay or...
That one, if I recall correctly, was $350. Those are 2008 prices, so I don't know if it's
They could have gone down or up.
Yeah, exactly. Who knows in this economy? So.
All right. Well, the book again is called Cranioclepty: Grave Robbing and the Search for Genius, and the author is Colin Dickey. Thank you so much for spending some time with us. That's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program. Tune in next week for another great show. And in the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org. You can also find us on Facebook and iTunes. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beale, for all of her hard work. And thanks to Colin Dickey for being with us this week. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening. Thank you.